Greetings, and welcome to The Thirsty Mage, the podcast that's taking inspiration from tonight's topic by splitting the episode into multiple chapters. I'm your host, David Loy, and yes, we are finally going to be discussing what could likely be the biggest RPG in 2020, and that's Final Fantasy VII Remake. But just like Square Enix, we're breaking this discussion up into multiple episodes. This episode will be spoiler-free, and we'll be focusing on non-story aspects such as combat, graphics, music, and all the nuts and bolts that make up the game. Next week will be the spoiler cast where we discuss the story, and we'll have a discussion about where we'll think the title will go from here. But we'll see who's on tonight's pod, and tonight it's actually a two-man show with me, and as always, the man filling the Biggs role, NWR Reviews editor, Jordan Rudick.
Yeah, hi, David. I guess it's just Biggs and Wedge tonight. No Jesse. I don't know who Jesse would be. Maybe Casey or something like that. But yeah, this will be a fun one. I know we've both been playing the game a lot. I'm pretty close to the end with the final chapter. Like, I'm gonna finish it tonight for sure. But it's been a hard game to put down. I haven't played a game in a while that I felt so compelled to just stay up late every night and finish it. Like, I've been doing really long sessions with the game. Like, I wouldn't play every night necessarily, but I'd be putting in like 2-3 hours every time I'd have a session. Like, it was very hard to just do like half an hour at a time. You really want to sink your teeth into this one. So I'm not sure what kind of sessions have you been having with this one?
Pretty much identical, actually. It's one of those ones where if I only have an hour, I almost don't want to play because I know I'll end up spending like 2 or 3 because you get engrossed in the story and then mm-hmm. you either forget what time it is or you just can't put it down at all. So there's been a few times where I would start around 11 and then quickly realize it was 2 a.m. and have to get to bed. So I'm about 3/4 of the way through, I think, and we'll definitely be done before our spoiler cast next week.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking more about the story and even the more depth on the characters and the ending and stuff like that. Not quite there yet, but just a funny thing that was happening to me. I reviewed Trials of Mana. We're going to talk about Trials of Mana in a few weeks. I was going back and forth a couple times between that game and this game, and I get screwed up because they both have that action RPG combat style, but the buttons are different, right? So I'd be playing Trials of Mana, and I can't remember, there's like a heavy and a light attack, and then I'd go into FF7 Remake, and I'd be like, oh, there's only one attack button, and you just hold it down. Like, it's a little bit different process for the two games, but kind of playing them simultaneously for a week or so was really kind of screwing me up. So I was happy to be done with Trials, and now just focusing on this game. I really do enjoy the combat in Remake, but we'll start talking about that in a little bit.
Yeah, well, you might as well kick off. There's only 2 drinks, so.
Mm-hmm. So I've got something a little different today. I've been trying to drink like a smoothie every day just to get some more fruits and vegetables in my diet. I don't really love eating vegetables. I do like fruit, but I'm also lazy and I want things to be kind of expedited or compacted together. So smoothies have worked out well for me. We've been doing a lot of the meal prep stuff, or kind of getting invested in the meal prep stuff. We've got some food deliveries happening next week. I also tried a smoothie delivery service. So they deliver you like it's about a 200-milliliter cup. This is the company is Revive Superfoods. And they sent you order the different types of smoothie packages online, and you just add your milk or your water, your juice, whatever your liquid you would blend it with. So the one I've got tonight is called Matcha Maker. It is inside, it's got apple, banana, kale, pineapple, zucchini, parsley, hemp protein, matcha, and baobab. I have no idea what that last one is. it's good though. I tried like a strawberry one, a blueberry one. I've got all these different flavors. The matcha isn't very strong a flavor. Like my wife noticed it a lot. She didn't really care for this one, but I like it a lot. I add a little bit of honey just to make it sweeter. You know, that's my shtick. But and then I'm adding cashew or almond milk, whatever I've got in the house. So this one's pretty good. They come out pretty thick unless you add a bunch of liquid and then it waters it down kind of. But these Revive Superfoods, I got 65% off my first order. And that's a really good price. It ended up being like $2.50 per smoothie, something like that. I saw the regular price was about $6.50 per smoothie, and I'm like, oh, that's a little bit too much. So I put my subscription on hold. So I've done the 1 month thing because I got a discount on it. I put my subscription on hold, and like within 5 minutes, their customer service has emailed me saying like, oh, we noticed you put your subscription on hold. Like, you know, you can you mentioned that the price is a factor in your decision. Do you know you can save money by just ordering less? And I'm like, you know what? I get that. I understand. And if I order less, it's going to be cheaper. How about another 65% discount? You know, like give me another coupon code or something. But it's good to try. I think people should try this one. You know, reach out to me later on Twitter or something like that, and I'll hook you up. But I like the smoothies, but I don't like them $6 worth. If I'm going to spend $6 on a smoothie, I'll just go to like Jamba Juice I can't remember what the smoothie places are near me, but
Orange Julius or something.
Yeah, something like that. You know, I'll go and get like a fresh made one or something rather than the frozen ones. But it's fine, it's good. If I get another coupon code, I'll come back. But $6 is a little bit too much. $2 was a good price, and I was happy to try it out. So that was a Revive Superfoods. You can get a good discount if you are trying it for the first time. But I think this is the deal with all of these kind of meal prep servers, like or services. They hook you in with this really good opening deal, right? 30, 40, 50% off. But then after that, you're back to the regular price, which I don't think is necessarily a great deal. So maybe they're banking on people not canceling or just really liking the convenience. But yeah, this was one I wasn't going to stick around for. So we'll see. I'm going to try another one next week, a food service one, and we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I'm have the exact same with I tried out a smoothie. I guess it was a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Where I tried out a smoothie at one of those places, like I can't remember which one, but like a chain.
Yeah.
And yeah, I couldn't believe the price, but it was, at the time I was like, okay, well, you know, I'll give it a try and see what it is. But then when I saw what was all going into it and then realized I was paying $6 for that, I was just like, these are all like ingredients I could buy for, I could just like throw in my blender at the house. Like, I can't really justify dropping $6.
Yeah, exactly. Like
on something like this.
So, and like, it's good. Like, they're tasty and stuff, and I appreciate it. But it's the markup just seems really, really high for something you could do yourself. The convenience is nice. Like the I've got these little cups, and they're stored in the freezer. I just pull one out and I blend. Like, that's great, but it's still a lot of money at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly. So
what do you got for us tonight?
So my drink is very on brand tonight. Mm. So I've spoken a few times about the Scotch Ale from the local pub that I go to, Gainsburg. What I've got tonight is a new version of the old Great.
Mm.
So this is a new version of their old Scotch Ale. Okay. This is the 90 shilling, and it is good. It's different from the Scotch Ale that I enjoy, that I always try to get when it's available. It is seasonal, so it's out now. But they had this Scotch available, which is a new version, and 8%, and it's the same sort of thing where it's put in like the barrel, oak barrels and stuff, and got the nice Scotch. I guess the one thing though with this one is the one I'm used to is 10%, and this one's 8%.
Yeah.
So it's a little on the weaker side, but it's still it's got a nice flavor to it, but. Yeah, I just thought it was a very fitting beer for, you know, Final Fantasy VII. You've got the original that we've all loved and enjoyed, but it's a little bit different.
David, you're the only person I know personally that would call 8% a weaker beer or a weak beer. Like, I mean, compare that to like a Miller Lite or a Bud Light or something like that. Like, to me, that's a weak beer. And it's like, you know, 3.5-4% or something. But 8% is weak for you. It's kind of funny. But yeah, you're approaching like wine levels of alcohol content. Like, that's not enough.
It made me think of the beer that you found for me this week. The
yes,
Untitled Goose Ghost.
Yeah. What is Ghost? Is Ghost a type of beer? Like, that wasn't a term I was familiar with.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. A month or two ago when I did, I think you were sick and it was just me and Guillaume.
Yeah.
And we learned about what ghost beers were because he had one. Yeah. So it's if I remember correctly, it's like a German beer. Oh, I'm trying to remember. I think it has to do with the type of fermentation they use. Like, they use like a fruit for the fermentation and stuff, but. We definitely learned that night from Googling it right before the show what a ghost beer is.
Was so that you who had brought it on, or was it Guy who brought that on?
It was Guy, actually.
Okay. So have you tried a ghost beer before? Like, is that?
No.
Oh, so, that's why you were looking it up.
First I've heard of it.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. Well, I don't know if this one's this untitled Goose Ghost, which is kind of a funny name, if it's going to make its way out to you. It seems to be very local. I think it's brewed in a municipality close to where I am. So just outside of Vancouver, there's a city called Surrey. My wife's from there, actually. And it sounds like that's where it's from. But my friend who sent the picture to me, he's in Victoria, which is a capital of BC. That's it's on an island, like a ferry trip away from where I am. That's where he said he picked it up. But I'm definitely going to keep an eye out for it. And if I find some, maybe I'll see if I can ship you some. It'd probably take a month or so to arrive, but at some point we'll be talking about the beer on the podcast, maybe.
Yeah. I feel like we missed an opportunity to copyright this whole video game and beer hybrid synergy thing going on here, that it seems like a pretty big deal now that,
yeah,
like every time I go in the grocery store, it feels like I see a new video game based beer. And I'm thinking 2 years ago when the podcast started, I should have jumped on some kind of copyright something.
Yeah.
But I guess I missed the boat on that one.
Well, you can still come up with a Thirsty Mage beer at some point. You know, that'll be the goal. You know, just commission some brewery to take on our logo and put that on their beer.
Is it 14%?
Yeah. Oh my god, that's just nuts. It's funny, this proliferation of gaming or kind of nerd culture, geek culture themed beers. Like it's obviously working as a marketing tool, right? Like even if it's not a beer you would try originally or a company you've heard of, you see the goose, you see Pac-Man, you see the Sonic type background, the Green Hills background on these beer cans, and you're like, I want to try that. No matter what is inside, like, it's really good marketing. Like you look at that can and you're like, oh, that can itself is enticing. So you're going to try the beer. And then if you like it, you know, you're sold, you're hooked. So yeah, it just seems really, like, really smart kind of combination of factors there with the beers.
Yeah. Especially like when you're at the grocery store, the beer store, and there's like basically literally hundreds of beers to choose from.
Right. Yeah.
They're all just on like a wall. To have something that catches your eye is, mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody's picked up on something smart, because yeah, it definitely catches your eye when you see these video game based bottles and they just kind of pop out at you.
I mean, it's funny. I liken it to, you know, looking through the eShop. Like if you have a good kind of image for your game on the eShop, then people are going to check out your game. They're going to like maybe watch the trailer or look at like what the game is actually about or what genre it is. But if your eShop logo sucks, then everyone's just going to pass you by. You know, same thing with a beer. Like if you got a generic, you know, red or green or black label with nothing fancy on it, how does anyone know to choose that one over something else unless you word of mouth, you know? But with these gaming beers or gaming themed beers, you see an attractive can, you're going to pick that up, right? I think I like when wines, beers, spirits, when they all do this kind of fancy looking bottle that kind of catches your eye, I think it's smart. And I know that we, you know, in my household, we've bought a bunch of stuff just based on an attractive bottle. You know, if for nothing else, like you're giving a gift, your gift looks nice because it comes in this fancy bottle, you know, regardless of what the content is, how good it is.
Yeah. And then the other thing that catches my eye is at the store is when they put like the World Beer Awards logos on, sure, there when they win awards and stuff. So
yeah, that's a smart thing to advertise as well.
And speaking of a game that's probably going to be winning a lot of awards this year, I would guess.
I think so too.
That's this one. Mm. Yeah, I just think it's there's a few gripes that I'm sure we'll have throughout the way, but generally speaking, I've been very pleased with the way that Final Fantasy VII Remake has turned out so far. Like I said, three quarters of the way through, pretty happy with most of it. Mm-hmm. The overall experience definitely has been terrific.
Yeah, I think it's lived up to the hype. You know, obviously this is something that got announced years ago, and it was a very long time coming. But I think people seem generally satisfied with it. There's a higher level of nitpicking just because of how long we've waited, and because it's a remake of such a beloved game. And you know, it is a remake, almost a reimagining. It's such a different experience, but I think it has lived up to the hype. I think that it's a fantastic game. I think it appeals to a lot of different people. Maybe we should talk about just before we get into it proper, like who's responsible for this game? Like, who, David, tell us who made this, who put this together?
Yeah, so a lot of the names that stuck out for me are all people that actually been around at Square since the original Final Fantasy VII. Mm-hmm. Like, all these guys have actually worked on it back in the 90s. So the director is Tetsuya Nomura, producer is Katase, the writer is Nojima. So all of these guys, like, again, all of them worked on Final Fantasy VII. Mm-hmm. Nojima actually wrote a lot of the spin-off stuff from, like, Advent Children.
Right, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so, and obviously, a lot of the people that worked with them, there's plenty of new, would be a plenty of new folks on the team. Mm-hmm. That we probably just don't hear about. Like, obviously, a lot of the artists would probably be of the younger persuasion. Sure. And there's some other writers that worked on it. And I guess the big thing is that this is a game made by the people that worked on the original. So they obviously have some skin in the game of wanting to at least keep the spirit, or, you know, the nuts and the skeleton, I mm-hmm. guess, or try to keep it to as close to the same experience as possible while still giving you something new.
I mean, I don't think they would have done the project unless they had some of the original developers on board or willing to work on it or still at Square or something like that, right? I think back to, like, the famous example of Final Fantasy IV, you know, one of my favorite games. The director was, if I'm not mistaken, Takashi Tokita. And he also worked on the DS remake of Final Fantasy IV, in addition to a lot of other Final Fantasy games. But I think they asked him at some point, you know, are we going to remake Final Fantasy V, remake Final Fantasy VI in the same style as Final Fantasy IV DS, which is a dramatic kind of reimagining of the original game. It's a very different experience. It's got voice acting, all these different things. And he said something along the lines of, and obviously I'm paraphrasing here, that you want the person who originally made the game to make that decision, right? You're not going to kind of step on other people's toes. Like, if you didn't direct the original game, you're not going to direct the remake of the game, because then it taints the experience, or it affects the product or the text that was created in the past. So there's a respect for what came before. And maybe it's a Japanese developer thing. Maybe it's just a game developer thing. But I think we see this, especially with Square Enix products, that if they do remake a game or remaster a game or whatever, they want the original cast of people designing it to be part of that process, maybe a major part of that process. And so, you know, it makes sense. It stands to reason that they brought, you know, Nomura, Katase, Nojima, these guys back for Final Fantasy VII remake.
Yeah, and it reminds me of Saga, like, mm-hmm. when they're talking about bringing back, like, Romancing Saga, yes. 3, and the driving force behind it was, like, this young guy who was at Square who was kind of put into that mm-hmm. role of, you know, taking it on, but then would really only do it with Kawazu.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's like, okay, you know, so you got this kind of young guy who grew up with it who wants to redo it or at least, like, remake it or get it back into the give it an mm-hmm, audience mm-hmm. again, but would only do it with the original guy, yeah. Kawazu in this case, and again Square Enix. So it there's obviously a pattern here of, you know, they want to go back and look at these old games, but they want to make sure that the people that made them are involved.
Yeah, I can't imagine a Saga game coming out without Kawazu. Like, I think, you know, as soon as he retires, I think that series is pretty much dead. And not to say that it's, you know, alive and well right now, but he's the one kind of responsible for making sure that series lives on, and it's very much attached to him. And I could see people just kind of shying away from it once he's moved on from video games. You know, like, how can you've got this huge legacy to live up to, and that, you know, 15, 20 games in a series, you make the next one, it doesn't have that same flavor. It's just not going to go over as well. Like, I think of something, this is an RPG, but I think of something like the Professor Layton games from DS and 3DS. When the original puzzle maker passed away and they had a new person come in and step in to do all the puzzles for the most recent game, Lady Layton, I can't remember the subtitle. That game was dramatically different from the Professor Layton games, and I don't think the reception was there, the audience, and I don't think it's any surprise that we haven't seen a continuation of that series or that it's moved to mobile, because you really lost something charming and unique, maybe that can't be replaced with other developers. It's cool. It's cool, but it's also sad to see that someone has such a an art to them or a style to them that it's just so hard to replicate. And when you try to replicate it, and everyone's like, "Oh, this doesn't play like the games I played before," and then you kind of just drop the series. You know, all the popularity seems to dissipate there. So, but you know, we're taught that's not happening here. Obviously, like I think a lot of the popularity of Final Fantasy VII, the original, has carried through to the remake here.
Yeah, and in this case, the remake starts off with Midgar, and I think a lot of people. Midgar is Final Fantasy VII. Mm-hmm. There's so many people who've started Final Fantasy VII and kind of gave up after, or not, maybe not necessarily gave up, but just like the first, you know, 6 to 8 hours of going through Midgar is almost a game in itself.
Yeah. I mean, you meet so many characters in Midgar. You fight a lot of bosses. Like, there's a lot of story that happens there. It feels like you're solving this big, huge problem in Midgar. You're trying to. It is its own very major sub story in Final Fantasy VII, and it sets up everything that comes after. It's kind of maybe emotionally draining could be a word. Like, to finish Midgar, to get through most of it, by the time you do in the original game, you feel like you've accomplished a lot, and the world opens up to it, becomes more of an open world game after Midgar. And it's daunting for that to happen after 10 or 12 hours, you know, like it's, yeah, I think to the fact that I don't know exactly where the original PS1 game broke, but there were multiple discs, right? And I think it's shortly after Midgar that you switch to the second disc, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so.
Even that physical process of taking a disc out and putting another disc in, like it's like, oh man, I beat a major, major part of this video game.
Yeah, and it's such a contrast too, because Midgar is so confined and dark. Mm-hmm. And then you step out into the world and it's just open and bright.
It's
and beautiful.
Very different,
so it's,
yeah.
Yeah, very different. And that darkness pervades
for
here.
Sure.
I feel like the setting of Midgar, they did a very good job of capturing kind of the spirit of the mm-hmm. city. All the places that I remember all are here, and they're pretty highly detailed. Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about one very specifically when you hit on like level of detail? I was blown away by this place. Like what setting or what area of remake have you been to that you're just like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen? Like, did you have a moment like that, a kind of epiphany moment? Like, wow, this is the glow up right here. Like, this is the one.
For me, it was Aerith's house.
Yes. Yeah. Same here. Like, it is. I can't believe the waterfall in the background, the flowers. Yeah. Just the design of the house, it's breathtaking, actually. Yeah. Like, I don't take screenshots of PlayStation games. I don't take screenshots of any video game, but I had to stop and my pick my mouth up off the floor. I've never seen something so beautiful in a video game. Like, oh my God, it was immaculate.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And then even to have, and then the plate is kind of like broken up above them to allow the sunlight in. And it's basically perfect, like the only place that gets natural sun in Midgar is like
that,
Aerith's house.
And the chapel, right? Or the church, when you, in that flower scene, like it reminds you so much of the original game, actually. Like Aerith's house, a lot of the scenes that revolve around Aerith are very, very true to the scenes in Midgar with her in the original game. Like I think they really nailed the transition from original game to remake with the meeting of Aerith and kind of the bigger interactions around her home, her environment.
Yeah, and then just all the flowers and the house itself, like the her house is beautiful.
Yeah, this you're asked a question, does the remake represent Midgar in a way that I would have envisioned? I think definitely. Like it feels repressive, it feels dark and scary and intimidating. There are pockets of humanity in the game, and you feel those as well in a place like Walmart, where you meet Don Corneo, and there's the gym where you do the kind of the weight the exercise mini game. I can't believe how well
the
they replicated that. It's great. Yeah. They really nailed some of the mini games that I wasn't expecting them to. The motorcycle one's another really fun one from early on in the game. Yeah, the level of detail is extremely high. Like, and the environments look gorgeous. I can't believe how much of a visual experience this game is. Like, it's you want to stop and like drink in all these environments because they're the level of detail and the polish on it, in terms of artwork is phenomenal.
Yeah, and it's funny because people were pointing out texture problems here, but the only memorable problem I saw with any of the details was early on in the Sunlamp area when you look down on, I believe it's Sector 5 you're looking at, and you're looking down and it does look, so something does look off. It looks like there's almost a lack of detail. I don't know if that's even like just my like the if you don't have a PS Pro, if maybe it's fixed in the Pro. You played on the Pro.
I am
Was
playing
it?
on the Pro. Yeah, I can't. I haven't seen any comparisons, or I've heard the talk that you're referring to, but I haven't like seen a side by side, so I can't really tell you. Like I can say that from my PS4 Pro experience on a 4K TV, like this is the best thing I've ever seen in a video game. Like I think of vistas where I was looking down over at the city or parts of the city that are kind of derelict or in various states of disrepair, and I'm just thinking, yeah, like this is, man, if this is next gen, like I might be on board right away. Like it is something else for sure. But I didn't really notice any. I mean, I'm not a very nitpicky guy when it comes to visuals. Like if there's small little things that don't line up 100%, it's not a big problem for me. I'm thinking of the overall design and the overall art. And to me, all the places that I went felt real. They felt like they could be environments that you and I could walk through. Like Wall Market was just crazy. Like
That was
what a
the
cool.
second most impressive place to me was Wall Market. Like
Yeah, for sure.
just that first walking in, and the guy, there's like a character who's kind of propositioning you in air,
Yeah, as soon as you
and you're
walk in, right?
as soon as you walk in. But then it's funny because I wasn't even listening to what he said because I was so busy like looking beyond him at all the
I know, I
craziness
know.
going
Yeah,
on, and
yeah.
I'm like, oh crap, I didn't even hear what he said, because I'm like,
You
this
know what?
place
That's
is
a.
incredible.
It's funny you mentioned that because that happens a bunch actually, where you're doing something like you're walking through a scene or the camera's panning and someone's talking to you, and maybe it's faint or the you're not paying attention to the subtitles or whatever, and it's just because you're so stunned by what you're looking at. That's happened to me multiple times where I had to like, oh shoot, was that person telling me something important or did I miss a major like story detail or something really interesting? And it's just I think it speaks to the quality of the art and the visuals. I do think it's very, very high. Yeah, Wall Market reminds me of like walking through like Las Vegas or something like that. Like walking through like old Las Vegas, where you're just taking it all in. You're just looking everywhere. You can't you want to look at multiple places at the same time, but you can't. And so just running through Wall Market was a really, really cool experience. I can't believe just, again that's one of the areas where they really nailed the feel of the original game. Like it felt seedy. It felt like it was alive though. It felt like risque and like a red light district. It did kind of bring all those feelings about.
Trying to think of any other particularly memorable places. Like obviously that first run to the reactor at the beginning.
Yes.
I don't know if they could have nailed that original run any better. Like it was exactly how I remembered it. Just with a much higher level of detail. And all the sectors, like all the slums and sectors, were interesting. I guess the one other interesting place was the early on, you're on top of the plate where all the Shinra employees are living.
Yeah,
Like
right.
those side streets are pretty neat to walk down and kind of see like the difference, like the nice houses versus the slums that you just came from.
Yeah, when you meet kind of where some of the more well-to-do people live that aren't living in the slums, you see that contrast. It is very much like a I would say night and day, but it's not night and day because it seems like it's nighttime all the time in these places. Specifically with the Aerith sections. But yeah, I think it's very early on. Is it Jesse's mom's house you go to or something like that? And it feels like it just a whole new world actually. Yeah, like a surface level and an underground or I don't even know what else you would call it, but it does feel like two very separate worlds there in Midgar. I wanted to mention, just before we step away from the setting, the linear and open world sections. We were talking about this a little bit before we started recording, where I think one of the strengths of the game is the places where you get to roam more freely and can talk to people and go to shops and do side quests. Those are stronger sections of the game. But then when the game is more linear and you're going through tunnels and sewers and corridors, those are less interesting and more... they just feel like you're kind of grinding through them. You know, every 30 seconds or so, there's a fight with enemies, and so you have a little bit of combat. You do a little bit of exploration, finding treasure chests or destroying the Shinra boxes, or doing like a small little puzzle. Some of which will be very familiar to those who played the original game. But I think those you'd call them dungeon segments. Or corridor segments. I don't think they're all that compelling. I think that they feel very much like you're just helping you get from A to B. That transition, I don't think, is super effective.
No, and I think the most disappointing spot in that regard was, I think, the train cemetery for me, because that was linear, and it just felt like it was maybe an hour or so too long.
Yeah,
just felt like, am I done yet? Am I done yet? Are we through yet?
Because
it was, and especially since I remember that being kind of a memorable place from the original, so it was kind of disappointing. Where it's like I didn't feel the same feeling in this game. It felt more like a chore to walk through it than something fun to kind of look and explore.
Yeah, so the game's divided into chapters, and some of them are significantly longer than others. Some of the beginning chapters are much shorter, some of the later ones are much longer. Around when you meet Aerith, I think some of those chapters are quite long as well. And the problem with the lengthier chapters is that they're often lengthier because of the padding and the grinding, like the too many puzzles, too many fights with minor enemies. The boss fights are always excellent. I really, really enjoy them. There's a sense of tension. I'll talk about that more when we start talking about the battle system. But the boss fights I really looked forward to in this game. I wish that there could have been a little bit of trimming on this game. I think if you trimmed about 5 to 8 hours, I think that would have been great. In my playthrough, I'm on the final chapter. I think I'm very close to the end. I'm at about 26 hours, and you guys know I run through games pretty fast. So this is definitely a 30 to 35 hour game, I would say. I think it would have worked a little bit better closer to 25 hours, and then a little bit more for completionist's sake. But yeah, you can definitely see areas where the enjoyment or the compelling gameplay dips a little bit, and while you're waiting to get to the next major plot point.
Yeah, I would completely agree. That's the same feeling I'm getting.
So what about characters? Like, how do we feel about the characters? Who did you like, David? Who did you gravitate towards?
Like, Jesse was a standout for me early on, and then as we got through, I think Madame M and Leslie were both standouts for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but Leslie and Madame M, both characters you meet in Walmart, they're kind of centered around the meeting of Don Corneo. I liked Leslie a lot. I think he seems very villainous, right? Like it seems like there's a lot going on with him, I guess. And we'll talk about that more next week. Madman was just funny to me. Like, she was very kind of in your face and like sassy and wasn't going to take shit from you, you know, like whatever you wanted, like it was going to be her way or the highway kind of thing. And I liked that about her character. You know, it's nice to see kind of stronger female characters, especially in a place like Walmart.
Oh, I meant to ask you at the time, what level of, I don't want to get too detailed because I want to save it for next week, but there was three, when you first meet Madam M, there's three options. There's cheap, middle, and then expensive.
Yep.
Which one did you go with?
You know which one I went with. I'm pulling out all the stops when it comes to
so you dropped the highest money.
Yeah, I can't remember how much gil it was. Like maybe 3,000 or something 000. Like that. Which was a lot at the time, right? Like this isn't super far.
It was half
the
my
game.
Money.
Yeah, it was a lot.
It was half the money. Yeah.
There are a lot of parts of the game actually where I did feel pressed for money. Like I was selling stuff that I was finding, or not that I was like avoiding fights. You can't really avoid a lot of encounters, and I was doing every side quest, but there were times through the first half of the game, or first even three quarters, I would say, where I did lack for money. At the end, this is less of a problem, I would say. But I liked her. I liked I like Marley. Marley is a character you meet early on as well in the Sector 7 slums. I don't think she's in the original game. Correct me if I'm wrong about that, David. Do you remember her from?
I don't remember. I'll Google it while we're talking, but no,
Sure.
I don't recall her from the original
Yeah,
game.
so she gives you kind of housing or a place to stay when you first get to when you first go to the bar, and you meet when you meet Tifa Barrett and Barrett's daughter Marlene. So you meet Marley, and she's very like protective of Tifa, and like, what's this mercenary doing here? What's Cloud doing here? Kind of got her eye on you type of thing. But she
No,
you warm up to her.
just
But
remake it, looks like, yeah.
okay, yeah. So one of the new characters, I think Leslie's one of the new characters as well. You meet Roach, Roach, Roche,
Yeah.
very early on
Another
as well.
soldier.
Yeah, he's another member of Soldier. He's funny, he's very full of himself, obviously. And but I liked the interaction with him. It was kind of cool to see Cloud
He
fighting
seemed
other
very
soldiers.
yeah, he seemed very anime.
Yes. Oh, for sure, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, very, very
Like,
kind of a hyperbolic and melodramatic, but funny. Like I think he added like a lightheartedness to the scenes he was in.
I'm trying.
There's also like the expansion. Obviously, you mentioned Jesse, but like Biggs and Wedge, they obviously have bigger parts to play in this game. If you've played the demo or seen any of the footage, you already know that these are much more central figures because you're taking an 8 to 10 hour game in the original and expanding it by 3 times in the remake, and so. It stands to reason that characters that were more minor are going to have more major parts. And I like all of them, actually. I really like their interactions with Cloud and with Barrett. The whole cast of Avalanche to me is compelling. There's
How
not a
could you
lot.
not like Biggs when he's got the same voice as Balthier?
Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah, Balthier's one of my favorite characters, especially because of the voice acting. But yeah, they all feel like sympathetic. Like I want to go have a drink with them. I want to go to Seventh Heaven and sit down with them and just chat about what's going on and bash Shinra and talk crap about them. Like, yeah, I think the game does a really good job of making you like all of the characters. You might by the end of it, you might not, but I think that it does a very good job of trying to get you to like all these characters. They all feel sympathetic. They all have their interesting kind of personality traits to them. They all feel different from one another, and I come away being at almost at the end of the game thinking there's not really anyone I hate. Like I'm surprised by that. Like I like ev everyone feels they either feel true to what they were in the original game, or they've added like a new depth to them that is worth getting into or worth exploring in more detail.
Yeah, no, I totally agree that they're all wonderfully written, all wonderfully voice acted.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's very little complaint about when it comes to the
For
characters.
sure.
And then the level of details on the characters, I couldn't believe
Yeah.
how much detail.
Yeah.
Like, especially when you look at like the weapons they're using, or
Yeah.
the especially like you're looking at Cloud and he kind of looks exactly like you would think, but then like his the amount of detail in the swords are is terrific. And then the materia that's play that like the colors just pop from the
Yeah,
weapons,
it's
and then
great.
obviously they match the materia that you've chosen in the menu, so the colors will match. And even to the point where for example, like in one of the swords there, there's 3 materia slots, but 2 are connected,
Yeah.
and you can even see that in the
You can see the
sword.
connection. Yeah, it's very, very
Yeah.
cool actually that it's that kind of environmental storytelling, or that you look at your character and you know kind of what they are equipped with or what they're ready to bring into battle, I guess. Like it makes sense that there's a lot of detail on Cloud's sword, for example, because A, there's going to be multiple swords that you equip throughout the game, and B, you're always seeing the back of Cloud, right? Like the
Yep.
perspective of the camera is centered behind him, so you're going to be looking at his sword a lot because it's attached to his back. Do we know how it's attached? I heard someone say magnets. It sounds like magnets when he puts it back there,
Yeah,
but
that's what I thought too.
yeah.
Like when I see him do it, it seems like there's like a magnet in
Yeah, like
his
maybe he's wearing
upper
like a
back or
vest that
something.
has a big magnet on the back or something, but it's always cool the little sound effect when he slides it back into its holster on his back. Like it just has a nice ring to it, I guess. And Yeah, all of those little details kind of culminate in a very likable and realistic cast. But yeah, you nailed it with the detail on the weapon. I was always thrilled to see him equip a new weapon and see what it looked like in combat, but also just what it looked like as you're traveling the environment.
Yeah, and then Barrett's guns. Mm-hmm. Like, he's got, I think I've got, I'm up to 7 or 8 now.
Yeah.
And it's to the point where, like, I've got 4 or 5 guns, but then now I've also picked up a few physical attack ones. Like, mm-hmm. I've got these massive, like, this one big claw.
Yeah.
It's like a pincher. Yeah. And that one's pretty neat. And a wrecking ball.
Yeah, the wrecking ball. Just, I was using that. Yep.
Yep. So it's, and then Tifa has, there's like a cutscene where I actually noticed the most where I gave her like these feather gloves and I forgot I even gave them to her.
Yeah.
Until I saw in the cutscene and you see like the feathers around her wrist, yeah, and then the materia, and I'm like, wow, like that is so detailed.
Yeah, same thing. Like I had Tifa wearing like a pair of claws, like metal claws, and there'd be a cutscene where her glove hand is close to her face and you see these claws come out, or they're already out. I'm like, yeah, like it really is very, very detail oriented. And I appreciate what obviously the time and effort that went into that. I think it really, really makes the game feel realistic.
Yeah, exactly. And then the also making the game feel very emotional, yes, very real, was the absolutely wonderful music. Mm-hmm. We had discussed earlier about the people that were working on the original game, and so like the composers for this one are Hamazu and Suzuki.
Okay,
did I say that right?
So you've got your try, and now I'm going to give one. So the first one is Masashi Hama. I think it's Hamautsu. Because you got to do Hama as 2 syllables, and then Utsu should be 2 as well. So I think maybe Hama Utsu is what I'm going to go with. And then second one is Mitsudo Suzuki. That's a little bit easier, the second one. But now, did they work on the original game as well, David, or are they new to this one?
Yeah, no, they were around.
Okay.
And then they had Uematsu come back to just to there was just the one song that... because I believe he has cancer, actually, Uematsu.
Oh, no.
So they had him come back to help out with one of the songs, okay, but it was the former two that have done the majority, right, of the work. Actually, they weren't on the original. They've been around in Final Fantasy, but okay, not 7 specifically.
Gotcha.
Like,
yeah, I understand.
Final Fantasy 10, Final Fantasy 13, Final Fantasy 13 2, Lightning Returns. On the Final Fantasy X remaster. The last game they did before this was actually Alliance Alive.
Oh, really? Okay, that's kind of random.
Yeah.
So they're not just working with Square Enix games then, because that was an Atlas game, if I'm not mistaken.
So they've been, like I said, not the original guys, but almost like a passing of the torch, I guess, to a certain extent, to have Uematsu come in. And
for sure, and I think the soundtrack is actually pretty different. The remixes and the orchestrated versions of the songs, whatever you get, it's almost like you get a hint of the original themes, but they're very much their own set of tracks, I would say. My impressions are largely favorable. Like, I really like the soundtrack. My problem is I don't get to hear it very much because there's always people talking. Like if you're just walking around the slums, there's all these background noises of the NPCs talking. The characters are talking all the time. Like, and I'm not complaining about it because the voice acting is great. But in a game where there's so much voice acting, the music, I think, takes a little bit of a backseat. The only times you really hear a ton of it are during battles, right? So boss battles and during regular combat when the characters kind of shut up a little bit and are only kind of talking, you know, sparingly when they're defeat an enemy or use a spell or something like that. But there's the CD collecting minigame. I really like that because it gave me a chance to sit down for a second and listen to each track. And there's jukeboxes everywhere that you get to play the music in the slums, for example. And you're just collecting the various tracks in the game. So you get to hear all of them if you're collecting the CDs that are scattered around. And I really liked the mini game because it gave me that chance to kind of stand alone with the music and really drink it in. And I need to go back to this soundtrack when I'm done with the game and just kind of listen to the songs outside of the game, because I think this might be one of those really, really all-time soundtracks. From what I have heard, I've really, really enjoyed.
Yeah, I agree. I think it'll be interesting to listen to it after the fact. I think, yes, like when everything's said and done, and then because then you'll have that feeling of when you heard, because you'll hear it and you'll remember where you were.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
So I think it'll have a bigger impact listening it on its own later.
Yeah. So,
but I really do think it's a terrific OST.
So let's do this. Let's make an agreement here. Well, before we record the next episode, I'll tell Neil to do this as well if he's going to join us. Let's all listen to the soundtrack, like just kind of like while you're driving or while you're, you know, just doing something else, not kind of associated with video games. Like, I want to see, how does this sound when I'm going to get my morning coffee? Like, and I'm just listening to the tracks outside of the game. The game is done. How was it at conjuring up those memories of the different places I've been, the different events in the game? I think it's going to be really, really strong. I don't like the Chocobo sound, the theme. I think that they went so hard in a different direction on some of the sound, some of the tracks, that they're almost unrecognizable from what the original was. And the Chocobo one's one I didn't particularly care for, but I think there's some that I really do like. I don't want to throw around any names yet. I don't want to go through it myself, but let's come back to the music maybe for a segment next week. It's worth talking about more.
Yeah, sounds good. Mm-hmm. So I guess we'll end with the big one. That's yes. The combat of Final Fantasy VII. This was the I would say, well, probably the biggest bone of contention for many
for
is
sure.
that they did not go with a traditional turn-based system. This is kind of an action RPG hybrid, I would call it. Mm. I don't know. I think it largely is successful, at least for the way I played it. It works for me. Like, I'm enjoying it. It doesn't feel like you have to mash buttons. Like, there is a lot of strategy still to it. Mm. I think my initial feeling was that I felt like there was a little bit too much rigidity to how you had to win certain battles.
Yeah.
But then when I look back to like the original and to other turn-based stuff, it's like, well, that's kind of like a common theme where, you know, a lot, there's always like the weakness that you have to exploit, mm-hmm. even in a traditional turn-based. So to kind of give these guys crap for that, I don't know if it's too fair.
Yeah.
I think what I was comparing it to is like something like Nier Automata, where you could just go do fight however you wanted to fight. Like, there was multiple ways to defeat enemies. It was just kind of like, do your thing and whatever you're enjoying, go with. Mm. Whereas it's not quite the case here. There still is like a weakness or a strategy that has to be employed to defeat the tougher enemies.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of boss fights in this game where you want to like analyze them. Like, you get a materia very early on called Access.
Yeah.
And that one, it's basically like scanning the enemy to find out what their weakness is, but it also tells you not just their elemental weaknesses or resistances, it tells you kind of the strategy for taking them down. Usually, like, when the boss does this, you should use this move, or it will be totally invulnerable at this point in the fight. So it was really helpful to get that kind of information. I had that materia on cloud at all times, but I do think it's kind of an RPG convention where you are forced to bring certain materia into the battle. The problem is you don't always know, so I think it's good to go in with a variety, right? Like, you want to have probably, you know, like lightning, ice, and fire. You probably want to have each of those at least on one of your party members at all times, right? Just in case you need one. I like how the game forces you to not just do physical attacks or magic. Like, there's a good mix of the two. I think the meters build up too slowly. I think that the ATB meter is less of a problem, but the limit break builds up very, very slowly. I wish that was faster. I think you pointed out in the notes, the AI, it targets the character or the enemy you're fighting against. Is that right? Is that how it works?
There's a few battles where it's like, okay, I'm fighting as Cloud and he's getting low on HP. And what I would do is I would switch to another character, and all of a sudden they would ignore him.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, leave him alone.
Oh, yes, I see.
Come attack me.
Yeah.
And we'll wait. And when the meter gets up, then I'll heal him, and then I can go back to him and fight again.
Yeah.
But it seemed like I would just, it was whoever I was, the computer was like, okay, I'm coming after you
yes,
now.
Yes, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, so.
And I ended up using it as a strategy eventually, once I figured that that was the case. Mm-hmm. Like, they were almost ignoring the other characters.
Yeah, I don't like that. I know what you're saying. So whatever character you're controlling is the one that the enemies will target or the boss will target, no matter what. So if your character's really damaged and you switch to someone else, they basically won't hurt that person. They might hurt them a little bit, but they're not going to like, use all their heavy attacks on them. The I guess going hand in hand with that is that the AI characters in your party don't really do very much. Like they don't use they don't use special abilities. They don't use magic. They don't really attack very much or do a lot of damage. They're kind of just floating. And I think that kind of sucks, actually. Like, it makes the game feel unrealistic. So when you get into combat situation, like, if there's three enemies and three people in your party, it's basically just 3-on-1. Like, it's everyone against Cloud or Barret or whoever you're controlling at the time. And then when you switch to Tifa or Eris or whoever, then it's that person against the three enemies now. And yeah, I don't love that. I wish the AI was better. It's not the AI was. It's a deliberate choice. I feel like, but I just don't like the choice. I wish you know the enemies would attack other people or your characters would contribute more to the fight. Like the game almost wants you to switch between party members very very often. And I have to say there were a couple of really fun moments where. You would activate like an ability with Cloud and then quickly switch to Barret and activate one of his abilities and then switch to Tifa and activate one of hers. And then they're all like using an ability at the same time when you kind of like let the battle play out. And you could do a ton of damage that way. It was really satisfying to see that. But I guess that's how they want you to play. It's funny. It's a funny way of designing the combat. And I'm not sold on that.
No, and I felt like there wasn't great balance between the magic either, because like when you use fire, it immediately hits the opponent, but if you use blizzard, there's a delay, and if the enemy moves, then it actually doesn't even hit.
Yeah, that was annoying.
Because there's like an ice that builds up above the character, and there's at least like a 1 to 2 second delay before it even hits, so if you're not attacking a stationary opponent, then it doesn't even hit. And it's the same with the wind, mm-hmm. too. That there's this delay, which is very irritating. And then the other problem I have with, like you said, the meters take so long to build up. But then if the enemy hits you or does something that interrupts whatever you were about to do, not only do you not do the move or the item or whatever it was you were about to do, you lose the meter.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, you can get so interrupted.
Like you
and
almost
lose
have
your...
to look around and make sure you're not about to be hit, or you'll just like cough up a meter that it took you a good 10 to 20 seconds. To
yeah,
build
you
up.
Have to time your attacks. One of the attacks I really hate is the first one Cloud starts with, and that's Braver. I don't know how many times I used Braver and missed because you think the enemy's right there and they quickly move out of the way or they interrupt you or something like that. It's a little frustrating.
Infinity's End is even worse because there's like a longer buildup.
So.
For the attack.
Here's the trick. Only use triple strike. Because triple strike, you just run to the enemy and you attack them three times or attack three different enemies and basically never misses. Triple strike, I've used it like 80% of the time, which is a little, it's funny. It's a little boring, but it gets the job done. I don't even think I'm very good at the combat. Like I don't know how to really do the perfect guard where you like guard at the right time and then you do some kind of parry attack. I block when an enemy is going to use like a super attack against me or something like that, or I try to dodge out of the way. But I don't think I'm good at the combat. I do... Overall, I enjoyed. I think the implementation of the ATB meter and the way it builds up when you're doing auto attacks, I think that's fun. I think it introduces a nice risk reward system where you basically have to be doing auto attacks to earn the ability to use an item, to use a magic spell, to use an attack ability. I think that's a compelling gameplay system. I think that works. I think that part of the combat works. I think the summon monsters are disappointing. I've got a handful of them, but every time they come out, they're just kind of, so the way summons work in this game, this isn't a spoiler or anything, like it's a basic mechanic. You summon a character like Ifrit or Shiva and they come out and they become like an extra party member. You can kind of control them. You can use ATB meter charges to give them, to give them directions to use an attack. But normally they're just doing like kind of basic attacks. And then before they've got like, they're on like a timer. And when they leave, they do like a super attack, which are those visually, they're cool. But the whole time they're out in the fight, I don't think they're doing very much. It doesn't feel like they're really present, you know, like they're just kind of floating around.
Not a whole lot. Yeah. Well, and it's kind of disappointing that you can only use them on boss in like the boss fights.
Is that right? Yeah. I can't.
I've never seen them not in a boss fight. Like, because it, I don't know if there's anything in particular that triggers, because you have to, the summon meter has to build up to the point where you can then summon them.
Yeah.
But I've never seen them outside of a boss fight.
Something about taking a certain amount of damage or getting dropped to a certain point. I think I've seen them in maybe one or two like really tough basic enemy fights. Maybe you'd even call them mini bosses, and maybe that's the stipulation. Maybe that's why they were able to be summoned. But yeah, you can't just bring them out at any time. I guess I'm purist in me. I'd rather have something like Knights of the Round or Neo Bahamut or something like that. That I use it. It comes out, does a lot of damage, and then it's gone. Like I feel like when they come out and then their meter is trickling down to their super attack, I'm like, hurry up! I don't care about your basic attacks. Just do your super attack already. I need you to like finish this guy off. You know. I think this, the way they're implemented is a little bit funny. It's different. It's something we haven't really seen before as much, but I didn't love it.
Well, it kind of reminds me of Final Fantasy XII.
Okay.
Like the way that the summons work there, because they replace, like in 12, they actually replace the other two characters. Yeah. But it's still the same sort of thing where they're out for a specific amount of time, and then you can trigger them to do their moves while they're out. And then they just kind of
I guess
away.
It is kind of similar to that. Maybe a little bit more hands off, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you wrote down favorite character. So which of the characters you used in combat, who do you like using the most, and who did you end up using the most when you had a choice?
Yeah, it's definitely Cloud. I don't even think it's close.
I can't imagine that anyone's played this game and wasn't using Cloud the most.
Yeah, like it's definitely, and because for me it's like Cloud, Tifa, Barret, Aerith, and it's mostly based on using a sword. I think is just the coolest. And then Tifa's next because she's so quick, and then the other two, it just seems so hand off, because like with Barret, if you're using one of his guns, you're just standing still shooting, so it's kind of, you know, I don't know. You just kind of there, and then Aerith is the same, where you just stay back and shoot. But she's even slower. Like the rate of attack is very slow. So it's,
I like her abilities, and her magic power is really, really strong. But her basic attack is very, it's almost annoying to use. It just doesn't feel satisfying. Yeah, like you're shooting out these little orbs of light, and they do decent damage sometimes, but they come out so slowly. It just doesn't feel that fun to use her. I think what's great about Cloud is that he's fast. His sword can hit multiple opponents, as when he's dodging and zipping around. Like, he and Tifa are very fast characters, and I think that makes them more fun to play, because it's an action RPG. You want to be a fast character, right? Like, you want to zip around the battlefield, dodge enemies, go in and out. You know, Tifa has this attack. It's like Star Strike or Star something, where she like punches a bunch of times and literally flies around the screen a little bit. It's awesome. Like, I love seeing it. It can hit multiple enemies too, so that's a really cool one. Yeah, definitely Tifa and Cloud.
And I mostly play in Punisher mode with Cloud. Like, I'm almost always in Punisher mode.
See, I'm just never in Punisher mode, because I prefer him quicker. I'd rather zip around more. I feel like he's too slow.
He attacks quicker. He just doesn't move as fast.
Yeah, I guess I'm often like circling around and going in and out. I'm doing a lot of kind of bobbing and weaving with Cloud rather than just sitting there. Okay. Yeah, I would do like three or four attacks, build up an ATB meter, use a triple strike or one of my ATB charges on something, can run away and then come back in. So I'm doing a lot of like diving in and out. So that Punisher didn't really work for me. That Punisher he has two different attack modes. Punisher, and what's the other one? Operator. Yeah. So Operator's a little bit faster in term and less damage focused. And Punisher's a little bit more, you're slower to dodge, but you will do more damage with your attacks.
I'm not all offense.
I know you are. You're trying to chop all the NPCs down in the slums, no doubt. But
there's obviously the bosses. You can't just go in guns a-blazing, but everything in between, I'm going.
Oh, sure. Tilt. Yeah.
I think one of my favorite for using like Punisher is Beck's game. they're pretty interesting. I'll leave it till next week though, because those guys are new characters, and they're pretty fun.
Yeah, just a bunch of punks that you meet, but they're pretty flat. They're pretty hilarious.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol. Get going.
So yeah, this is a great time to get into the last call. So for this week, the last call topic is, does the turn-based action hybrid satisfy enough people on either side of the spectrum? Or does it just alienate those that are very turn-based oriented or action RPG purists?
And can I tack on something to this as well? Like whether we want the next game, the next non-Final Fantasy VII remake game to have this type of combat. Like whether that's another remake of a different game, whether that's Final Fantasy XVI, whatever the hell they're going to call it, is it going to use, if it used this one, how would we, if it used this combat system, how would we feel about that?
Yeah, for me personally, I don't know, like, I almost wonder if it was better just picking one or the other, just because I don't know on the whole if people, like, what people like, but I just know I'm not a really big action RPG guy, so for me, the Platinum games are kind of what action RPGs are for me, where it's fast, it's quick. You can fight however you want to fight. It's just kind of that kind of cinematic, crazy anime kind of style fighting. Like that's the action RPGs I enjoy. But then I go back to, like, when it's turn-based, I kind of like my strategic, you know, take your time and think about what you're doing kind of turn-based. Like, I think the torchbearer for turn-based these days is Persona 5. Like, you know, it's you take your turn. It's not that you have to make quick decisions. It's no, there's a lot of different options that you can do. It's each person's turn. You know, you do your thing. There's different ways to kind of to like, you can hit weaknesses so that it gives you extra hits and that sort of thing. Like, there's a lot of strategy based to it, but I don't know. I enjoy the combat in Final Fantasy VII, but it's one of those things where, like, had the game stuck to the traditional turn-based, would have enjoyed it more? I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, that, I guess that's the question, right? Like, if you could remake this game and choose one of those, choose for it to be strictly turn-based or strictly action RPG rather than a hybrid, would you enjoy that more? I think the answer for me is maybe, but I really did enjoy what it turned out to be. I think this hybrid system works. I'm looking forward to doing more of it in the second and third and 10th part of the remake of this game, whatever number they decide to go up to. I think the combat's fun. I think there's a few tweaks they could do to make it better. I think if the way your teammates worked and the way the AI targeted you worked a little bit better, I think the summons could change a little bit. But I think the kind of the meat and potatoes of it, or the bones of it, I think are strong. I like the fact that you have to charge up the meter to do attacks. I think it makes the battles feel tense. It makes them feel like, you know, there are a lot of boss fights where I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to win this. Like, I've lost two characters. I'm going to have to use a Phoenix down. Then they're going to have a little bit of health left, but I've got no ATB charge. I need to go in and do some damage right now to build up my meter so I can actually use a Phoenix down. Those sections are really tense, and I would end up dying a couple times as a result, but it felt really satisfying to be able to get in quickly, build up my ATB meter with Cloud, revive Tifa. Tifa's got a revive spell, so I don't have to use any more Phoenix downs. I can revive Barret with her, and then I can start healing everybody back up. Like, there's a lot of times where I'm not healing when you get down to like 75% or 50% health. Half the time when I'm playing this game, maybe it's a David style, I'm not healing until I get to like 10%, you know, like when I'm down to like the red meter, and, you know, that maybe there's a sound effect or something like that, and my characters are clearly very, very close to death. That's when I'm starting to use healing spells, and half the time I'm going to be too late, and I'm going to have to use a revive or a revive spell or Phoenix down. I think this works for me. I think it's worked for a lot of people. I think they found an interesting way to combine the two. And we've never really seen this before, right? We haven't seen a combination action turn-based system, at least not one as distinct, I think, as this one. I can't think of another game that does it like this, where you actually stop time to input your turn-based action, your cast your spell or use an item. I don't know if it's frustrating that it takes an ATB meter to use an item. I think it fits, but it was scary times. I want to use a Phoenix Downer. I want to use a potion, but I need to charge up my meter just to do that. It felt like I'm taking a lot of risk to do something minor sometimes. Just because I remember, David, quickly, I'll let you jump in. The thing I wanted to talk about with combat that I forgot was I hate the enemies that are airborne. Because you can't even to switch to Barret, or you can't really attack them. But then if Barret has a melee gun attached, like the cannonball or something, you have to rely on Cloud or Tifa jumping up into the air to strike those enemies. I hated those parts, actually. Very frustrating.
Yeah, Tifa was better at the airborne stuff than Cloud. But yeah, like if you didn't have Aerith or Barret, then you're in trouble.
Guys,
and then you can't even
very annoying to fight, right?
Oh yeah, they were the worst. And the Drakes.
Yeah, the Drakes were really tough too because they fly around a bunch.
Yeah, so yeah, they're the most irritating. But you can't go into the menu during the battle, so you can't even switch like the guns out or something.
That's right.
So whatever you go in with, because there was a couple times where the materia, I felt like there wasn't. The materia slots were pretty, what's the word? Like there just wasn't very many of them. It felt like I was always flipping materia in and out. So there was a couple times where it was like, I took maybe Blizzard out for something else and then realized that the fight I was in needed a Blizzard materia. And I'm like, I'm screwed.
So this is it. So I was thinking about this today because I thought we were going to talk about it. The problem is, if you think about the original game, you had enough slots for the materia that you had in your possession. But in this game, the materia you get, it's like two or three times the number you get in the original game. But the number of slots you have hasn't really changed.
Yeah.
You still have about 7 or 8 slots on average. But you have 40, 50 materia to choose from. Unlike in the original game where you probably didn't have enough materia to fill all your slots.
Yeah,
right. Specifically went and bought a bunch from the store in the slums in the original game, you wouldn't have enough. You wouldn't collect enough. But there's so much materia in this game that you almost don't know which to bring into which fight. That's why, again, I tried to have one fire, one lightning, one ice for every fight, because I'm probably going to need one of those, right? Lightning, I think, is the most utilized one. Like, because you fight so many mechanical enemies.
Yeah.
I combined the elemental materia with the lightning one on Barret's gun. So every time I'd get into a battle with him, I'd be shooting lightning bullets, right? And so he was super helpful. I actually controlled him a lot because I'm able to do a lot of damage to the mechanical enemies with his lightning charged ammunition, right?
Yeah, and the fact that there's so many, there's not a ton of time to actually build up the materia to like level it up.
Yeah.
There's one materia I got called Pedometer, where it just says like, when you have enough steps with this particular thing, something wonderful happens. And it's like, I don't have a slot for you for a useless materia.
if you like, after we were done recording, I can tell you what that becomes. You can see if you want to keep using it or not. But we'll spoil it fully next week. But I think that we're maybe on a slightly different sides of the fence here with the combat. I think it works overall, but not everyone's going to love it, right? And you can't help but wonder what if it was a different style and not this combination style.
Yeah. I think the biggest improvement that they could make between here and even the next part 2 is I think if the AI controlled allies attacked more and built up their ATBs faster, I think that might alleviate a lot of the problem I have with the system, because then all of a sudden you're not building up to use an item and it being like a big hindrance, because now that I've used the item, I can't use the weakness element or something like. Whereas if the allies are building their ATBs, maybe I could use one of them and they can quickly use an item and then I can still use one of my abilities.
Yeah.
So I think that would fix a lot of the problems and it would still keep the system intact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think maybe little tweaks can really make this a system that everyone would enjoy. I think it's good already, but we definitely both agree on what the shortfalls are.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
If a Final Fantasy 16 or a Final Fantasy 6 remake came out and it was this style, I would be okay with that. I think we just have to come to terms with the fact that Final Fantasy is not going to be a turn-based series anymore. I think they've moved away from that. As soon as 15 came out, that was kind of like the push into the action side. I think they've done a nice job of bringing a turn-based element into 7 Remake. We're gonna, it's not like there are no turn-based RPGs, right? Like we still get, you mentioned Persona 5, we've got Bravely Default 2 coming, that's turn-based. We're still gonna get turn-based. It's not turn-based RPGs are not dying. It's just some of the series where they were really familiar to us, those series are pivoting because they've gotten bigger, right? They've become more mainstream. Like 7 Remake is a super mainstream game. And it's, yeah, you mentioned at the top of the episode, it's going to win a lot of awards. It sure is. And a lot of people are talking about it, playing it. It has to appeal to a wider audience, and turn-based RPGs just don't do that. So I've said my piece about it. I'm okay with that. I recognize the series isn't going to be what it used to be, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
I think for Square Enix, I think Octopath Traveler is probably going to be taking the torch for...
Yeah. Yeah,
for the turn-based, the traditional turn-based, like they just went heavy into that traditional, and that I think that's where it's gonna stay.
Yeah,
and
well,
there's a big enough audience there that there's gonna be another one. Like there
will sold be 2 million copies. Too. It's coming to Stadia for some reason at all. I don't know, but Octopath and Bravely, like the teams that are working on those games, they are. Yeah, you're right. They're carrying the turn-based torch, right? Even Tokyo RPG Factory, right? Their first two games were turn-based, and then Oninaki was not. It was more of an action-style game. Yeah, so even series that might be carrying the torch could change. Like, you could see maybe Octopath Traveler 2. Maybe it does some kind of hybrid thing as well. Who knows, right? Like, there's potential for... these developers always want to be experimenting, right? They want to try new things. So, we'll see. I think there's always going to be turn-based, but... We just can't always expect the same games to stay turn-based. Things change, right?
Especially with Square, they're certainly no strangers to evolution. They'll force it if they have to. They're unafraid.
There is one, and we've talked about this game. There is one series that probably will never change.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's Dragon Quest. Dragon Quest. It seems, they're just constructed to stay exactly the same, and I think that's fine. Just Dragon Quest will always be your traditional turn-based series, and Final Fantasy will be whatever the heck it wants to be.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we've reached a good point here. So next week we're planning to do a spoiler-filled episode. So if you haven't played the game yet and you don't want to be spoiled, maybe catch up with us in a couple of weeks. I think are we doing Trials of Mana in 2 weeks, David? Is that the plan, or is it?
That's the plan.
Okay, cool. So, that'll be fun. I reviewed that game, obviously. Really enjoyed it. Gave it an 8.5. I've got a couple of videos on NWR TV, our YouTube channel, if you want to check those out. I did a review of the game, Trials of Mana, and also I looked at the New Game Plus feature that happens after you beat the game. So if you want to check out that, you can do it too. But yeah, we'll be talking about it on the Mage. I think Casey's going to join us for that one. That'll be a fun episode. We want to thank everybody for joining us, obviously, as usual. If you could leave us a comment or review on your podcast app of choice, subscribe if you haven't already, that would be awesome. You can check out some of our latest reviews on thethirstymage.com. We've got a review for Dread Nautical, which David did, and we've got a review for Sakura Wars, which I did. Both interesting games, very different ones, though. You can see those on our YouTube channel, The Thirsty Mage. You can reach out to us on Twitter at The Thirsty Mage. Give us some feedback on the episodes. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, upcoming games that you would like us to talk about, upcoming episodes. We're still kind of we're always thinking about games we want to play and think about the next weeks and months ahead. But there's a lot of there could still be a lot of quarantine left to go. So we're still trying to figure out what we're going to be playing in the summer. So yeah, let us know what you think. If you have... sorry, David, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the one thing that I haven't actually mentioned on the podcast yet is that we are doing a giveaway
at
thethirstymage.com. So if you want to get the details of the giveaway, the gist of it is if you're subscribed, or if it's a YouTube-based giveaway. So Shin Megami Tensei 4 for 3DS, Paper Mario the Thousand Year Door for GameCube, and The Flame in the Flood, which is, it's an indie game, but this particular one is the physical copy that was published by Super Rare. So this was the second game that they published. They do not sell it anymore. So if you go on eBay, like the cheapest I could find was like $200. So when we hit milestones on YouTube, we'll be giving these away. So the first milestone is for Shin Megami Tensei. When we hit 250 to subscribers, I will be giving it away to anyone who's a subscriber and has told me they are subscribed on YouTube. So if you're already, like, if you've seen this giveaway on Twitter and you've already registered and sent me the confirmation, then you're good, and your name will stay in throughout the whole thing. If you're not subscribed to YouTube yet, go to the Thirsty Mage YouTube channel, subscribe, and then just send us a DM some way, so either through email or Twitter or whatever, just to let us know that yes, I'm subscribed and I want to be in the draw.
Yeah, and we're getting close to that number too, right? Like
we're passing 200 as we speak now, so we're not far off the first giveaway. And then at 500 we'll be giving away Paper Mario, and then at 1000 we'll be giving away The Fame and the Flood. So if you're listening to this and you want to get in on that giveaway, all you need to do is subscribe to the Thirsty Mage YouTube channel.
Yeah, that'd be awesome, guys, if you can do that. Win a free game in the process, maybe. Yeah, so lots of places where you can find our content. We've got more great podcasts coming at you very soon. A little bit more about Final Fantasy VII Remake next week, and then Trials of Mana after that. We're also going to be doing a couple more crossovers with Talk Nintendo. I think we're going to do Pokemon Red, Blue, and Yellow soon. I've proposed Star Tropics, so if anyone else there wants to hear about Star Tropics, give me a little bit of support on Twitter, or email david@thethirstymage.com. Let him know that Star Tropics is a game he should get, should pick it up. It's on Nintendo Switch Online, so it's we've all probably got free access to it right now. But that does it for this week, I think, David.
Yeah, sounds good to me. I think we crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
Fantastic. Thank you everybody again for listening, and we will talk to you very soon when we jump into a spoiler filled episode next week, kind of all the ins and outs of Cloud's story in Final Fantasy VII Remake. Until then, have a good night and stay safe out there. Bye.
Bye.